Thanks for listening to the Gospel Church Podcast. We hope that this podcast is used by God to help us all grow closer to Jesus Christ. If you would like to get connected to our church or give to the mission, you can visit our website at thegospelchurch.com. Now for this week's sermon.
We've been looking at Ecclesiastes last month into this month. In service to this question, what is worth wanting? And now we're in these middle chapters, what Monica just read to us, chapter, I don't think we had on the screen, chapter 8, 14 through 17, and then chapter 9, verses 11 and 12, our reference this morning. And so in these middle chapters, we're really proceeding much more topically and thematically. And so what she just read to us says to us that none of us are going to live a trouble-free life. The preacher of Ecclesiastes is acknowledging this. He's just pointing it out. He's not offering any kind of solution to it. He's just saying, if you want a trouble-free life, that's actually not worth wanting. You're not going to get that anyway. And so it's better to want a meaning in life that suffering, troubles cannot take away. That's actually what we do get in the gospel of Jesus. But what we have in these references Monica read from chapters 8 and 9 is the problem of evil. He uses the word evil there in chapter 9, verse 12, if you're looking at a text, but he's not going to do what's called theodicy. That may be a new word to you. It's not the name of a band that I know of, but theodicy is actually offering a defense of God's goodness in the face of evil, in the existence of evil. When we do theodicy, we're saying, here's how God has purposes that are ongoing for good, even in the existence of evil all around us. No, what the preacher does here in chapters 8 and 9 instead is he looks at evil as an imposition. It's inevitable. Evil is going to intersect with your life, be it in unrighteous expressions, be it in self-righteous expressions, be it something done that's definitely against us, being something negligent that doesn't feel like it's against us necessarily, but it is in effect. And so the problem of evil, we know it's not just a philosophical problem that has kept philosophers and theologians up at night. It's also a personal problem. It imposes itself on all of us in a fallen world. And so that's the preacher's topic. He has already told us about the existence of evil in the first parts of the book, and he's even talked about our sinfulness being evil, but now he's really talking about how evil just imposes itself on us, chapters 8 and 9, how we don't even see it coming, and it's just barreling down towards us. I was on the interstate. We live out in Bellevue, and it was one day this week. I want to say it was either, I guess it was Friday. I think it was Friday. Going home on the interstate, and there was a place between 196 and 192. We live off exit 192, McCrory Lane. Yes, we're that far out in the west. Now, Nashville housing prices are sending us to Dixon, practically. But the interstate slowed down. It crests this little hill where you've got, you know, the interstate was cut into the rocks. And I'm behind this trailer with a boat, and I look behind me, and suddenly there are cars doing this. Somebody didn't know that we were stopped over the hill, and so they came over, and suddenly I see this white van is sideways coming at me, and I'm thinking, I'm hit, I'm toast, they're going to hit me, and I don't know how I did not get hit, but that kind of barreling at you, you know, that's coming from behind me on the interstate. It's not something in front of me. And evil will catch up in some way. It will come barreling at you that way when you maybe least expect it. But evil, just to get a sense of what it is, because he talks about it here, St. Augustine probably gave us our best understanding of evil when he called evil a parasite. He said basically evil doesn't have a life of its own. It lives off the good that has to precede it. So it's a parasitic kind of existence. To exist, evil has to first have something good to deface, something good to debase. That's how evil works. My little grandson, Huff, he's 4. And he called me Tuesday night to ask why God made bad guys. This was a setup call. I got a text from my son earlier in the day. He goes, hey, Huff's asking big questions. I don't know how to answer. I want him to call you tonight. And so Huff gets on the phone. Pops, how come God made bad guys? Even four-year-olds can tell the world is off in certain ways. And by the way, he said my answer was awesome, as he says it at the end. Huff's here today. Eventually, all the evil that exists, here's gospel hope, just kind of starting at the wide mouth of the funnel, and we'll move down to specifics. But eventually, all the evil that exists, Scripture teaches, gets banished into hell. Jesus taught that. When the Lord returns, when new creation drops and new Jerusalem comes and the reign of Jesus over all things is undisputed. But for now, whether you call it problems or troubles or pain or suffering, any number of evil things that we don't want can come crashing into our lives, or even just sort of grow up in our garden, as it were. Where did this come from? And that's the preacher's concern in chapters 8 and 9 of Ecclesiastes. I was listening to some Coldplay this week. They have a song called Everyday Life. It came off their 2019 album. And it has this lyric. It was interesting to hear this again in the music working in this text. Their lyric, "What in the world are we going to do? Look at what everyone's going through. Everyone hurts, everyone cries, everyone tells each other all kinds of lies." The preacher here isn't addressing the lies we tell so much as the tears we shed over all the evil stuff. And, you know, some of those tears may be due to lies told against us. Some of those tears may be consequences for our own lying. There is the evil that we cause and that we contribute to, absolutely. But also the evil we experience is just this imposition on our lives. It's just there. It's out there. You don't know when it's going to show up necessarily, but it does. And he gives expression to this. The world is upside down in certain ways. Here's how he says it, verse 11 in chapter 9. "Again, I saw that under the sun the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to those with knowledge, but time and chance happen to them all." In other words, he's saying the way we expect life to go, it doesn't always go. We expect the race to go to the fastest, but the fastest may pull up lame in the race somehow. We expect the faster and the stronger and the smarter to succeed, but they don't always. Sometimes those with the most and the best still fail. Sometimes they blow up their own lives, or someone else does through something. The preacher of Ecclesiastes has observed how evil works in the world. And so among all the things that he's explored, he includes the problem of evil. I've pointed out to you a couple times already in our study that wisdom literature, which is what Ecclesiastes is, wisdom literature is interested in exploring boundaries, particularly what happens when boundaries are transgressed, when we try to blow past limitations. Ecclesiastes explores that. Wisdom literature explores complexities, that life isn't simple, people aren't simple. So wisdom literature is about boundaries, it's about complexities. Here in chapters 8 and 9, the preacher moves into this space that an old professor of mine used to call the expectation-reality gaps. We have these expectations of what we think life ought to be like, but reality might be different. And then we have this gap between the expectation and the reality. We expect to arrange our lives in such a way that trouble cannot hurt us. Trouble can't even get to us. That's the way we want to live. That's the life we think we want. And we go to great pains to make for ourselves, but then reality is different. And a lot of us will rage against this in our lives. Particularly, we do in advance and achieve cultures, the more success that we have. Because we believe if I just buy my house in the right neighborhood, if I send my kids to the right schools, if I get the right degrees, if I take care of my health, then I'm supposed to avoid the worst realities. That's what we expect. But the preacher of Ecclesiastes, it's like he plops down right in the middle of these expectations and says, "Why do you think of evil as a gatecrasher? It's had reserved seats all along." It's like the preacher of Ecclesiastes calls for the house lights to come up here in chapters 8 and 9 to see evil and the troubles it brings. They've had reserved seating to the show that is our life, even though it feels like they gate crashed. Because it says at the end of verse 12, it suddenly falls upon us. But evil doesn't gate crash. It just might be late to its seats in your show. Trouble showed up after the second intermission. You know, you had this trouble-free youth maybe, but then adulthood has been hard. Your kids gave you no problems until college. I know a couple who, not until their 70s, they were in their 70s, they had taken great pride in their children, the lives their children had led. They had a son who was particularly successful, and not until his 40s, they in their 70s, did they discover that their son was a raging alcoholic and was blowing up his life and his success. And now they were having to deal with the fallout of his actions. 70s. They thought they'd made it. They thought they'd broken the tape. They thought they were going to get through and, you know, pour the water on themselves after the marathon and drink the Gatorade and have the little silver blanket around them. And suddenly they're dealing with this stumbling toward the end of, like, now what do we do with this child of ours who's still our child, though he's an adult and he's blowing up his life and our grandkids. The preacher knows we want a trouble-free life. But this is not what we get. And this doesn't mean life is crappy and not worth living. You and I are actually spared, when you think about it, we are spared many things we could suffer. Me on the interstate this week. Just that moment of realizing I'm seeing in the rearview mirror a horrific accident happened behind me, and it's about to hit me, and no, it doesn't hit me, and I get to go on. My truck intact, my person injury-free. You're spared a lot of things. I'm spared a lot of things that could happen to us, and yet we do experience enough things in life that are painful and hard that we come to see what's worth wanting is really not a trouble-free life, because we're not going to get that anyway, and the preacher of Ecclesiastes wants us to be very clear-eyed and realistic about this. What we can get is a meaning in life that suffering doesn't take away. That suffering can touch, but it can damage, but it can't devastate. So we read chapter 8, verse 14. There's a vanity that takes place on earth, that there are righteous people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked, and there are wicked people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. And I've seen this also vanity. In other words, he's saying, why do bad things happen to good people? And why do good things happen to bad guys? Why do bad guys succeed and good people fail? And horrific things happen to people who don't deserve it, and people who do deserve it seem to skirt on through. He's articulating that. That's the way he articulates. It's kind of awkward in our English rendering, but that's what he's saying. And we go, we read 8:14, chapter 8, verse 14. We go, yeah, I've seen this play out. And we can lash out about it. And a lot of times we do. And we can go to blaming God. And that's understandable. And that posture, if you're a believer, if you're a follower of the Lord Jesus, if you love God, that posture, you will find it dissatisfying at a point. But let me be hastened to add here, it's not unbelief that shouts its pain and frustration to God. It's belief that does that. Unbelief is apathetic. Unbelief goes, well, you're about what I thought you'd be. Belief has to have a channel to express. And so you look in your Bible, look at the Psalms, look at Lamentations, look at Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. Look at the preacher of Ecclesiastes here, venting pain, saying, Lord, what gives? Why is it like this? Why does it have to be like this? Beat on God's chest, as it were. Belief will take our pain and frustration to God, but belief will also seek resolution. It has to. We'll seek a way forward out of frustration. We can't make our life there. We will seek a meaning in life that suffering and the despairs that suffering causes cannot take away for us. And you know, we're looking at Ecclesiastes, an Old Covenant kind of context. We live this side of the cross reading Ecclesiastes. And living this side of the cross reading Ecclesiastes makes a huge difference in these matters. Because whereas the preacher of Ecclesiastes plops down in the middle of these expectation-reality gaps and says, it's not right that bad things happen to good people. And we concur with him wholeheartedly. That's all he says. That's all he really knows. We know more. We know the true and better preacher, the Lord Jesus, entered the gaps himself. We know what's coming that he didn't know. That God would personally enter the same kinds of sufferings we undergo, subject himself to the kinds of things that the preacher of Ecclesiastes can only rail against. But Jesus didn't go at things ranting and raging. He hollowed out evil's power by the power of an indestructible life, as the book of Hebrews puts it. He hollowed out evil's power through his flawless life and sacrificial death and glorious resurrection. So while we are still scandalized by the imposition of evil on our lives, we're not devastated. Not when we know that our Redeemer lives and nothing separates us from his love, and yet, we still experience tensions in this. We do. The preacher of Ecclesiastes has taken us not just into a gap between expectation and reality, which evil often enters through many different doors, it seems. He's taken us into a tension that we live. Let me develop from here for you two big ideas of this particular message. The first one will be, there is purpose in living despite the imposition of evil inevitable. The preacher's working toward that purpose. It's coming, and how he'll conclude his book. We'll get to that next Sunday. Right now in these texts, he's just giving us the problem. The second idea that I want to develop for you is the presence of troubles in our life does not equate to punishment. So we're going to look at purpose in living despite the imposition of evil, inevitable, and we're going to look at the presence of troubles, what evil does, what it brings, does not equate to punishment. You're not being punished. When we suffer, when we are beset by things that are painful, by problems, bad things imposing themselves on us, we will wonder, is there a purpose in this? What could possibly be the purpose in this? And that's the philosophical side of things. I said earlier in the message that the problem of evil is both philosophical and personal. So the philosophical side is we wonder about purpose. What could possibly be the purpose of me going through this or somebody I love going through this? What's the purpose? That's the philosophical side. But there's also the personal side. We also will wonder, well, maybe God is punishing me, particularly if you came up in a tradition that, you know, preached grace as sort of this transactional encounter with God that you get saved by, but really preached law. You basically have to justify and sanctify yourself. You better live in such a way that God, you know, doesn't have cause to regret that he brought you in. I kind of grew up in that tradition. It takes a long time to detangle from that, to unlearn that, to recognize that, no, it's grace. Grace doesn't lead us to dereliction. Grace doesn't lead us to irresponsibility. In fact, Titus says grace teaches us to say no to ungodliness. But it doesn't use the law to do that. It uses the perfect life of Jesus Christ to say there's something better for us to go for. So when we suffer, we think, is there a purpose? We think, is God punishing me? Is the purpose the philosophical side? Is he punishing me the personal side? Let's unpack both just a bit. Let's look at this first idea I want to unpack for you. There is purpose in living despite the imposition of evil inevitable. When people, whether you go back to the ancient context, like the preacher of Ecclesiastes lived in, on down the timeline to us in our modern context, when we struggle with the problem of evil and the sufferings that it causes, there's often the assumption that because I cannot see a good reason in this or a good reason for this, whatever this is, therefore there isn't one. And it's understandable why we think like that. Why we think, because I can't see a good reason or purpose for this problem, this pain, this suffering, these troubles, there must not be one. That's totally understandable. We are finite, we are limited, and we can't see the whole picture. So we have to catch ourselves recognizing this about ourselves. We have to catch ourselves when we begin to move out onto that branch. And we have to take a more modest position, which is, if God is all-knowing and all-seeing, if God has all of time and existence before him, and furthermore, is personal and loving and good, then there might be, it is entirely possible, there might be purposes for things happening to me, things happening around me that I don't like. There might be purposes I don't know. There might be purposes I can't know and won't know. If God exists at a higher plane than I do, if I'm down here in the morass and he's above the milieu, then there might be purposes God has for things that I don't know and can't know and won't know. Think of Job in this vein. His book is also wisdom literature. Job repeatedly asked God, you familiar with the Job story? Common Old Testament figure, well-known Old Testament figure, the guy who lost everything. He repeatedly asked God why. Why did I lose all my children? That's what the text says. He loses all his children. He loses his health. He loses his wealth. He loses his esteem in the community. And Job says, explain it to me, God. And God never does. All God will say to Job is, I so highly esteem you, I allowed Satan to afflict you as I did to demonstrate how it is a human being can continue to trust God even when every human benefit for doing so is stripped away, with no explanation. That's basically the story of Job. Can a human being continue to trust God when every human benefit for doing so is stripped away, when there's nothing left? And what does Job say? Though he slay me, yet I will trust him, to the only person he really had left, his wife. And we say, yeah, okay, but the Job story, it isn't very emotionally satisfying due to that very dynamic. And I agree. I've taught the book of Job. And I've lived a couple of little portions of it. God never tells him why his troubles, and we so crave a why when these things suddenly fall upon us, as chapter 9, verse 12 puts it here in Ecclesiastes. But you know, one of the measures of spiritual growth, one of the marks of maturing in your faith, is you come to realize you are not owed an emotional satisfaction. And I'm not putting this in the terms of tough, you know, because we still feel this. We still feel this desire, this need. But one of the things you realize in growing in Christ is I'm not owed emotional satisfaction. And that doesn't make things robotic between God and me. It just means I have to entrust to God, even as I might argue things with him and vent my pain, I have to entrust to God that there are reasons and purposes on the grander scale of things I either cannot understand or simply am not allowed to know. And even if I could know, I still might not like the reason. Why do we assume that if I could just have a reason why, well, then I would get it? God may spell out the reason why, and I go, I don't like that reason very much. You know, it's kind of the same idea we have if God would just spell it out for me what he wants me to do. And then you go back into the Old Covenant, Old Testament context, and you look at how many times God spoke audibly to Israel and said, go do this. And they went, not today. I don't want to do that. He spelled it out. It's the very thing we say we want. But we assume I would like the reason if I could know. You know, if I could be shown, for instance, something painful in my life yet benefits all these people, gives them perspective and hope that my suffering brings about all this good, I still don't want the painful thing. Some of you know the name Stephen Curtis Chapman. I've always loved his music, very instrumental in my life, his music in college and in seminary. Still love what he does. You know, he and his wife, Mary Beth, went through a horrific tragedy in losing their daughter. And I was reading his biography, I don't know, 3-4 years ago maybe now, and there's a section where they talk about, you know, so much ministry value. I mean, the depth of their ability to touch people, as it were, because of what they suffered, it just went exponentially deep. And yet they both say, I'd trade all that in a heartbeat to have that child back. It's not worth it. It's not worth this pain that we've had to walk through. We know we've benefited other people in pain, but it's not worth it. And I feel the same thing about things I go through. But Again, I don't want any of this to sound like, you know, toughos. You know, just God is God and we're not. Deal with it. That's not the spirit of my preaching. But I've had to come to terms with only one of us in the relationship can be God. Okay? And if God can't displease me, if God can't confound me, if God can't contradict me, then I have a God of my own making. And that's an idol. We can't make ourselves the measure of all human reason because, look, that's not how relationship works. I mean, think about significant relationship. Your most significant relationships, I guarantee at some point they hurt you. They may not know they hurt you. You may not have the level of honesty to share that. But any relationship that's meaningful to you has the potential to hurt you because you have such a personal investment. It's much the same in relating to the Lord. And we're relating to Him behind a veil for now. 1 Corinthians 13 says, for now we only see things in part and we see things darkly. We don't see things clear and out in the open as God does. And so it can hurt us that God doesn't give an explanation. God doesn't give a reason. Even if we see people helped by what we've suffered, that's the reason. No, it doesn't feel like a good one. If or when hurtful and unfair things crowd into our lives and we think, well, because I can't see a reason for this, I can't see a purpose for this, there must not be one. And we want to call it vanity, as our friend the preacher of Ecclesiastes does. And we ask our searching questions, as Job did, where our faith is going to have to land eventually. And God is patient with us and kind to us in this process, but where it has to land eventually is if God is God and I am not, He can have purposes I don't know and may never know. And I don't have to like that. And Lord knows I don't like it. I've told Him many times I don't like it. I don't like this arrangement. But I'm still here. Because what I cannot do is conclude the absence of emotional satisfaction, the absence of a reason for me, means God isn't good. It just doesn't equate to that. Not when it's a matter of public record and historical fact that God entered suffering Himself to accomplish ultimate goods in reconciling the world to Himself. What other God has wounds? The good God is and the good He works in and through my existence, it's going to pass through some hard places for me. It did for Jesus Himself, who's God in flesh. And so my response to God in those questioning, awful times is to keep going with Him. I have to give up the emotional satisfaction of an explanation. But that doesn't mean I have to give up the relationship. There is a purpose. I just may not know it, may not be able to know it, may not be able to contain it. Second thing for us to think about, and then we're done. Even if we don't like the purpose side, the philosophical side of things, there is still the personal side. The presence of troubles due to the imposition of evil, just the presence of evil in this world doing things we don't like, the presence of the troubles in our life that are because of evil in the world do not equate to punishment. We are both temporally and ultimately in the hands of a God who was willing to personally suffer Himself on our behalf, the worst that evil had to offer. And that means, this side of the cross, troubles, hard things, sufferings we might go through, they're not punishments. Punishment has been taken off the board. That's why the cross of Christ exists. Punishment is taken away. He's punished on our behalf so that we don't have to be. You don't have a fear of punishment anymore. So when we suffer and we wonder, is God punishing me? Normal thing to wonder. But note here, even in our text, as you look at chapters 8 and 9, verses 14 to 17 in chapter 8, verses 11 and 12 in chapter 9, note that the preacher of Ecclesiastes doesn't point to anything we did wrong. And yet evil still imposes on us, often through no fault of our own. Look, the preacher of Ecclesiastes actually had it harder living on the side of the cross that he lived on, pre-cross. Because all this preacher had, at best, was hope of a future Redeemer coming to make things right some way, somehow. And to boot, his covenant context under the law of Moses said, if you are suffering, it is very likely that God is punishing you. God is defending His covenant, enforcing it. But we find the preacher of Ecclesiastes questioning this, actually, in chapters 8 and 9. He's got an inkling. It's not always that. The presence of evil is not always punishment. He's thinking this in his own covenant context. Evil can and does just impose itself. But eventually, what he didn't know, and we know now, is that God would impose Himself on evil to give it a mortal wound through the cross. Evil is bleeding out, even as we speak, because we have the longed-for Redeemer. this side of the cross, we know how God imposed himself on evil. And by what means? A who? The one who blessed us exponentially beyond what we could have asked for or thought of ourselves, so that no matter what comes into our lives, Jesus entered sufferings of all kinds personally himself. Name another theistic religion where God does that. That doesn't mean Christianity has an answer for everything. We don't. But we have powerful resources for the presence of evil in our world and the troubles and sufferings that result. And when you're in some kind of trouble and suffering and you want to give up on God because of it, listen, I'm preaching to you where I've lived and been. I can't believe God would let this happen to me. How could he let this happen to me? I'm going to give up. What happens when you do is you never realize the power of the resources. And you never realize that the power of the resources are often slow cooked. I mean, God's got like a barbecue pit back there, you know, just with his way and will. He is slow. He doesn't do any. It's not Waffle House, you know. It's more like Edley's. Okay. It's not microwave. It's much more crock pot. It's much more stew on the stove. It's how he works. One writer called it the slow rewards of fidelity. The slow rewards of fidelity. Of staying at this, not quitting, not giving up, not saying, because I can't see a reason or purpose for this, there must not be one, therefore I'm out. Or not saying, because this painful thing, obviously I don't want it, why did God let it happen? Therefore he must be punishing me. And God's saying, you're just leaving the cross out when you do that, when you make that conclusion. Listen, Jesus would be treated as if he was guilty of every failure, every negligence, every horror against people that exists. And what Jesus had done to him on the cross is he basically had Ecclesiastes 8:14 and Ecclesiastes 9:11 and 12 flung on him while he was up there, along with everything else about people that's disordered and dysfunctional. But he passed through it alive and well. And because he did, we personally have it better than the preacher in Ecclesiastes, in that we know the punishment has been taken for us. Again, the preacher doesn't say here that the evil is coming to us because the righteous obviously did something wrong. Therefore, no. He says evil just imposes itself. It's just that way. It's a fallen world. But if we go through things that the preacher here observes, and we will, it's not for punishment. What we know that he didn't is that the punishment has been taken already on our behalf. And so it might be for development that I go through these hard things. See, God is calling from fallen humanity a people for himself who will trust him come what may, but that trust has to be developed in us. The point of faith, the point of having faith, the point of keeping faith is seeing faith resource us when life is not rewarding us the way that we think and the way that we want. When we're the swift ones, just to turn verse 11 in chapter 9 over on its head, it says the race doesn't go to the swift. Well, what about when I'm the swift one? What about when I trained hard and ran my good race and it doesn't go to me, or the battle to the strong? What if I'm the strong one, nor bread to the wise? What if I'm the wise one, nor riches to the intelligent? What if I'm the intelligent one and I put my time in, I did my degree, I did my work? How come I keep getting passed over? Nor favor to those with knowledge. What if I'm the one with knowledge? What the preacher of Ecclesiastes shows us in these few verses, in the middle chapters of all his explorations of boundaries and complexities, and now these expectations unsought and unmet, he shows us we won't be able to avoid every hard thing. We simply won't. The problem of evil is real. We face it personally. It gets on us. Evil will get on us. I've got a little poison ivy on my left wrist here. I don't know how I got it. It showed up this week. Thankfully, it's a small area, but it begs to be itched at 2 a.m. for some reason. So then I'm up itching my place here, and then my mind kicks in. I'm like, I can't go back to sleep till 3:30 in the morning. But, you know, something got on me and left this, see this red puffy place here. Thankfully, it's just right there. Something caused this, and it made me think of something that I read not too long ago about a poisonous tree down in Belize called the poison wood. If the sap from that tree gets on your skin, it causes severe damage and pain. We've got a picture of the poison wood tree, so you can see it. just if a raindrop, from what I was reading, falls off that tree onto your skin, you got problems. It's that toxic. Here's a description from the website about it. The sap of the poison wood contains alkaloids that cause serious skin and mucus irritations after skin contact. Any part of the tree may carry the sap, so handling any part of the poison wood should be avoided. Even the smoke of burning its wood will be skin irritating and potentially damaging the eyes. The smoke, okay? This is a molecularly bad tree, all right? What's the cure for the poison wood tree? Well, there's a tree called the Gumbo Limbo tree. That has to be one of the best all-time names for a tree. The Gumbo Limbo tree is often found growing close to the poison wood. This is the Gumbo Limbo. They look similar, don't they? This tree bark will heal what the poison wood has done. They grow similar. They grow not similar. They grow same location. They grow close together. And it says on this website, the cure for the poison wood tree is the Gumbo Limbo tree, which is often found growing close to the poison wood. Bark from the Gumbo Limbo should be applied to the affected area, and the wound should be washed 3 times a day with water in which the bark has been boiled. Now, here's what I find remarkable by way of illustration. Two trees, one that harms, one that heals, grow side by side in the tropics. In everything that wounds us, we are never out of sight of the one who has wounds. Jesus was, in effect, crucified on a poison wood tree, if you will. And to what end? To do something lasting, to do something transcending about the imposition of evil, to counter its alkalinity, to limit its reach, to heal us from its touch. I will still think at times that hard things, bad things I experience amount to a whole lot of purposelessness, or maybe I'm being punished. I'll still go there too. God's finally had enough of me. But I have to look again and again to the healing tree always nearby, to the one who demonstrated there his love and his goodness for my own sake, for our sakes, taking on the worst evil had to offer, in order to give us his best. One of my favorite passages, and I'll use this as our benediction, is the end of Revelation. Listen to how it pictures what's coming, new creation, where there are no more poison wood trees. The angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb, through the middle of the street of the city, also on either side of the river, the tree of life with its 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit each month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. The Gumbo Limbo tree of all eternity. No longer will there be anything accursed, but the throne of God and the Lamb will be in it, and his servants will worship him. They will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads, and night will be no more. They will need no light of lamp or sun, for the Lord God will be their light, and they will reign forever and ever.